From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A sequel to Stephen King's The Shining is just one of many current productions in Georgia's multi-billion dollar film industry going on right now. So what else? Let's go on set in Georgia.
Here we go. Movie!
Made in Georgia!
We make films.
Movies?
Let's go to the movies.
Let's go see the stars.
Kalina Bowler is here with previews of what is filming in Georgia. She's a locations manager in the film industry and also host of the upcoming GPB podcast, The Credits. More on that later. Can you contain yourself?
Oh my God, no. How exciting is it, you know? I mean, there's so much going on in film in Georgia, and to have this opportunity to be here and talk about it with you, I'm super excited. So I'm ready. Let's go.
Well, I'm really excited about the credits, but we're going to get there. But as I mentioned, the highly anticipated sequel to The Shining, filming in Georgia, who could forget little Danny ambling around that big creepy hotel and this famous line?
Red rum! Oh! Red rum! Red rum! Red rum! Red rum!
And in the sequel, he is all grown up, back in a movie called Dr. Sleep. Now, this is based on Stephen King's follow-up novel. What can you tell us about this film, which continues the story that Stanley Kubrick, of all people, told in film?
Right. So Ewan McGregor actually plays Danny in this film. And now I will confess something. I have not read the sequel, so I am not going to speculate on whether they're going to follow it verbatim. But I hear that production is going well. I think they're going to go through production until December. And so far, so good, I hear. So
I can't blame you for not reading the sequel. They're big doorstopper books, though, Stephen King.
It took me
unless you're going on vacation for
right to read it. So, you know, that sort of thing.
We do also know Marvel makes a lot of films here in Georgia, but the competitor, DC, is also doing a lot of work here with a series called Doom Patrol. Now, this is filming in Conyers. What do you know about this one?
Well, 90s, maybe he was a heartthrob, but he was everywhere. Brendan Fraser is back in a big way with this series.
Oh.
Very exciting. I said, okay, this is a bold move for DC. I think Marvel has been out here really, really banging out in the pavement with their series and their films. And I'm glad that DC is jumping on board with some really good options. So Doom Patrol tells the story of this former race car driver. He gets destroyed, basically, everything except for his brain. He gets a second chance in a robotic body. So, you know, that already sets up story after story after story. So I'm very excited to see what they're going to do here.
And a brand new body is not bad for an actor making a comeback.
Right. Oh, hey, come on now. Yes, Virginia, let's go.
Michael B. Jordan working a lot here in Georgia. He played the arch-villain, of course, in Black Panther. And now he's joining forces with Warner Media. This is an initiative on diversity and inclusion in the film industry. So this is a priority on the set of Just Mercy, which is now being filmed in Georgia?
That's right.
Okay. Jordan's drive for adopting an inclusion rider was sparked earlier this year after he heard Frances McDormand's Oscar acceptance speech.
Okay, look around, everybody. Look around, ladies and gentlemen, because we all have stories to tell and projects we need financed. Don't talk to us about it at the parties tonight. Invite us into your office in a couple days, or you can come to ours, whichever suits you best, and we'll tell you all about them. I have two words to leave with you tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, inclusion rider.
So Frances McDormand there accepting her Oscar. What exactly is an inclusion rider?
So an inclusion rider is essentially a guarantee that production companies are starting to be willing to sign that ensures that their cast and crew and their staff on these productions are diverse in that they're looking at a large swath of candidates to hire versus, you know, people you may have worked on the last show with or colleagues you came up through school with. You know, they really want to stretch out and find really good people because we're out here and we're willing to work and we have wonderful ideas. And I think that too often production companies have overlooked a large, large group of talent. And so I'm glad that she mentioned something. I'm glad that filmmakers like Michael B. Jordan are taking this initiative. And I really think that one day we won't even have to have inclusion writers. It'll just be, you know, second nature.
Well, if you look around at your crews that you're working with now, how diverse are they?
I will say, I started in this business here in Georgia back in 2005, and I used to be the only Black person in the entire production office. Then I was one of maybe three. And now I'm seeing all kinds of faces of color, all kinds of genders, all kinds of people across the spectrum. And I think that is great. It's only going to make our offices and our sets better.
So before we go, I mentioned that you have an upcoming GPB podcast. This is called The Credits. Tell us about it.
So The Credits is essentially my love note to my fellow filmmakers and my fellow crew members that I've been working with for the past 14 years. So many of us stay behind the scenes and we do these often thankless jobs, but there are hundreds and hundreds of jobs, hundreds and hundreds of names that go past in the credits.
Seen those.
That don't get the credit. And that's what I try to do with this podcast.
Since you're our behind-the-scenes person, Kalina, what can you tell us that goes on behind the scenes in the credits?
Well, in the credits, we talk to all kinds of people. I have an upcoming interview with a stunt woman here in Georgia. I have an interview with grips, electrics, production people. And specifically, I love this one from a friend of mine, Stephanie Morales. She's craft services. And she gives people advice if you're interested in getting into the business.
Craft services means food in your business.
That's right.
The one
and much,
people.
Much more, as you'll hear.
Don't be late. You got to sleep in the parking lot. You sleep in the parking lot. And don't run out of water if you're craft service. And just be true to yourself.
Yeah.
We always say to each other, let's raise the bar. Let's raise the bar. Raising the bar isn't necessarily crown rack of lamb. Sometimes raising the bar is like Icy's, you know, watermelon Icy's, you know, and being there at the right time when they're all sitting in 100-degree weather, you
right.
know.
So for those of us who have driven by film sets, seen the people out there preparing food, it's not rack of lamb they're eating all the time.
Not all the time, but we do have that too. Hello.
Kalina, thank you so much. So now we have a little bit of a glimpse, a sneak peek, if you will, of the credits. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kalina Bowler, host of GPB's upcoming podcast, The Credits. We will be turning to her from time to time for a rundown of film and TV projects in Georgia. Thank you so much for listening to On Second Thought during GPB's Fall Fun Drive. Your support that keeps this program and all of the shows that you hear on GPB going, and those that make a difference for you and your life and for the rest of the community. So during our Fall Fun Drive, it's that time of year when we ask you to do your part. Here's how. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is On Second Thought. Before the break, we talked about some of the latest film and TV projects going on in Georgia. And now we turn our attention to the Georgia actor and scary alien who is in the new remake of The Predator.
Predators just don't sit around making hats out of rib cages. They conquered space. But that's not what's on the horizon.
Should I be worried?
Riley.
I think you know what is on the ship.
The actor wearing the alien mask is Georgia native Brian Prince. Brian was a student at SCAD when he plunged into the gravity-defying stunts of parkour. Videos of his prowess led to his big break in Hollywood. He's been a stuntman in Black Panther, Captain America, and The Walking Dead. And now he is the Predator. And boy, is he tall. 6'9". I asked Brian how he got started.
So I started doing parkour back in 2008. So back before American Ninja Warrior was like the big show it is now, it was a lot smaller. And it was originally a Japanese game show, and an American channel first started doing, like, they were airing it, and they had a contest for Americans to go over and do it. And in 2008, I was on my first summer vacation from college. So I was like, I'm going to do nothing all summer. I'm going to sit on this couch. And I'm watching Ninja Warrior, and I see these guys just like blasting through the course, and they're parkour athletes. And I was like, what is that? And so I went online, went to YouTube, and I was like, oh, this is that thing from Casino Royale. Oh, I've seen this in commercials. And I was like, I want to try this. So I've always been interested in like jumping and running around like that. But I was the same height I am now at that time. So I was like, no, I can't do that. I can't do that. And after about like 2 days of just looking at videos constantly, I was like, I have to try to do this. And so I went outside. And I just started like balancing on stuff and jumping over things, and I've never stopped.
Is Atlanta particularly parkour friendly? I mean, there are a lot of things to jump on.
Oh, there are. It's Atlanta's pretty good. One of my favorite places to train in Atlanta is Georgia Tech. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good leveling surfaces, walls and rails and things. And yeah, it's a great place to do parkour for sure.
So you were discovered because of videos of your parkour. How did that happen?
Yes. So I've been doing parkour now for 10 years. And I started before, like, when the film industry was really just getting started in Georgia. And so there was a lot of crossover. I had, you know, a lot of friends that just did parkour, but then we had some people that were like, we do stunts. And we're like, what is that? And, you know, we would show them parkour stuff. They would show us what they did for stunt work. And so just over time, I had a lot of friends in stunts that either also did parkour, used to do parkour. And it just kind of took one of them being like, hey, you should do this thing. And I was like, all right, put together a resume, you know, bad headshot, and submit it. And then that kind of just led to like my first gig.
Wow. So you were in the new Predator movie. This is the fourth in the series.
Yes.
Were you a fan of this franchise before this film?
I was. Admittedly, not the biggest fan. Not that I had anything against it. Like, I always loved the character. When I was in Vancouver while we were filming, they actually, at the Rio Theater, it's like the Plaza Theater here, but in Vancouver, they had a 30th anniversary screening. And so I was off that day and I was like, I'm going to go watch this. And so I just went to the theater and I sat in the crowd, and it was really cool because it was a packed theater full of all these diehard fans. And I'm just sitting in the middle and no one knows that I'm like the new guy in the suit, and it's good to enjoy it.
That's the thing. Yeah. I mean, you're dressed up in this suit. People aren't going to stop you on the street and say, you're the alien.
Yeah.
Unless you wear your costume around.
Exactly. Unless I can make like a really mean face and then they're like, oh, yeah, that's you.
Well, let's remind listeners of the first Predator film. This was in 1987. The elite military operation team discovers that they're being hunted by something that is non-human.
Billy, you know something. What is it?
I'm scared, Poncho.
Bull. You ain't afraid of no man.
There's something out there waiting for us, and it ain't no man.
So the original Predator was played by the late Kevin Peter Hall. He was 7'2", right? You're 6'9". Did you find this costume uncomfortable?
No, it was great. It was molded for me. So it was feel like a glove.
But how long did it take to put this costume on every day?
It actually wasn't that bad. I did a day of Walking Dead, and to put the face zombie mask makeup on took like twice as long as it did just to put the whole entire Predator costume on.
All right, you're leading to a question about, you've been on a lot of film sets.
Yes.
In fact, you were in the Black Panther.
Yes, I was.
So tell me, I mean, this is the biggest grossing movie now of all time. Any good stories from the set?
It was a really cool experience. They did a batch of reshoots in October. And so at that point, the first trailer was already out. And so I remember sitting in the theater. I can't remember what movie we were going to see, but I remember sitting in the theater when I saw that first trailer. And I was like, oh, man, I wish I could have been in that. And so then, you know, I'm back here. I'd recently come back to Atlanta from Vancouver. I was traveling around all summer. And then I get a call and they're like, oh, can you audition for Black Panther's reshoots tomorrow? And I was like, yes, where do I need to be? And so, I did the audition, they liked it. And so I worked, I think it was about 2 weeks, like 8 days or so, on the big final battle sequence as one of the Jabari warriors. And so like I'm in the background fighting.
Well, can you identify yourself? Like, can you see yourself or do you know?
I can't in this one, unfortunately. Yeah. Maybe in like the final cut, but everything's happening so fast. And I really couldn't even see myself, especially because we're all dressed kind of the same. But it was really fun because we had about a lot of stunt people out there, and we all practiced all these fight loops. And so we had this choreography that we would try to mix up so it looked like we were doing a lot of original fighting, and it was just a lot of fun. Going into Predator, I was, like I said, anything I had done on camera before that was mostly stunt work, and I really enjoy doing stunt work. It's very physical, but I'd never done anything that would consider, you know, more acting heavy, more emotional, more empathetic related instead of action. I just really found something in those moments. And so since then, I've been trying to do more acting. I took an improv acting class at Dad's Garage.
Yeah, I heard that.
I've been looking for more acting classes to do. And it's just, it really surprised me. It wasn't something I thought, I didn't expect the spark like that to happen. And it did. And there's just something about it when you're when you really sink yourself into a character and you just become that, and then you watch other people play off of you in their character, and it just helps even more.
That is Atlanta-based actor Brian Prince. He plays the alien in the newest chapter of the Predator series, which is now out in theaters. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back when Atlanta real estate deals could be made over a drink and a handshake, Atlanta's oldest strip club was born, the Claremont Lounge, which, as the late intrepid Anthony Bourdain suggested, should be a national landmark.
The most beloved institution in the entire city, a place of Renaissance-era beauty and erotic and sophisticated nightlife, where the shots flow out in tiny plastic cups. It's not like other strip clubs. It's operating on a whole other level.
Since 1965, the dingy lounge in the basement of the Hotel Claremont has been a place where fifth-generation Atlantans rub elbows with newly arrived hipsters and ladies who lunch with hip-hop artists. In June, the Hotel Claremont reopened after an extensive renovation, so we invited Dana Scythe to talk about the storied history of the place. She's a writer, and she collaborated with a photographer and a designer on a book about the legendary landmark called No Cameras. Hello, Dana.
Hi. Nice to be here.
I'm so glad you're here. I'm so curious about this place after looking at your book.
To hear the Bourdain clip was lovely and sad all at the same time. To prepare for this, I went back to my interview, and he really nailed it. He was so for women empowerment, and that's kind of what this story was for me.
Mm-hmm. He spoke to you about it.
He did. He did, and what the place meant to him and what Blondie meant to him and the women he got to know through the years and the visits he had here in Atlanta. And that's sort of what drew me to the project as well. It really is kind of this relic and national treasure, as he said. And the two women owners really had something remarkable and really cherished it and made it sort of untouched. It really has been an institution since 1965.
Well, I want to ask you about these two women, because you dedicate the book.
I did.
To the ladies of the Claremont Lounge, some living, some whose spirits are still there.
Right.
Women play a really powerful role here, which doesn't fit, let's say, the typical image of the strip club.
I agree. Tracy Brown and Kathy Martin are the two women owners of the Claremont Lounge.
How did they come to own it?
And, well, it's a fascinating story, which is actually what drew me to the project when I worked on the book. And it is this legendary story where you didn't know what was true and what wasn't until I got there. And there are parts of it that really feel like a TV movie, which is a man by the name of Stanley McDonald had the club since 1965. And in the 90s, he passed away. And before he passed, he willed the club to Tracy Brown and Kathy Martin. Basically, when he was alive, it was a 10% deal. And when he passed, they became full owners of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really a handshake deal but he definitely had certain stipulations that were not willed, which was don't ever change the place. And they really haven't.
And now, after the renovation?
Right. After the renovation, it appears the same. I personally have not been back. There's a part of me that feels like it is still within the Claremont that I knew. And not since it's been renovated and had this beautiful architecture, you know, touched and all of that. But it really is a relic.
Well, let's talk about how it became the Claremont Lounge. It was the Jungle Room originally?
That's right. So the timeline kind of goes something like this. In 1965, Mac secured a lease on the space in the 700 block of Ponce de Leon. And it housed the Claremont Hotel since then. And it was owned by a man named Charlie Loudermilk. And Charlie Loudermilk and Mac were friends. And it was literally a handshake deal, where they had this crazy lease that was like, I think it was like $3,000 or something. And then when I was writing the book, it was like $6,000 that they leased the space. But back to the Jungle Room. So it was opened as the Jungle Room, and then it changed at some point in time to something called the Playboy Club. And of course, Playboy
was not happy about
that. So then it changed after that. They had to shut down, I believe, briefly, and then change to the Claremont Lounge.
Okay, so Kathy and Tracy get it in 68, you said?
No, they actually get it in...
The 90s.
The 90s, yeah. Mac died, I believe, in the 90s.
So...
Or 2000.
What makes it so different from other strip clubs?
Wow. Tracy says it best, I think, which is you can be anything you want to be at the Claremont Lounge. You can be overweight. You can be 70 years old. You can be a lesbian. You can be so many things that maybe society won't let you be outside those doors, and particularly in regular sort of typical strip clubs where it's sort of Stepford Wives and look a certain way and feel a certain way, where these women are sort of empowered to be who they want to be. And I think the customers there are the same. One of the dancers, Little Kathy, said, I always remember this quote, she said, the Claremont Lounge to her was like a dive bar that happened to have strippers on stage. And I think that's it. It's a dive bar. It's your local neighborhood joint that happens to have naked ladies.
Atlanta's Claremont Hotel reopened this summer after an extensive renovation, a matter of concern for fans of the dingy club in the hotel basement. It's a place where old Atlantans raise glasses with of-the-moment celebrities and no cameras. That's a house rule and the name of a book about the legendary Claremont Lounge. Dana Scythe wrote the book and told me that the strip club has a family vibe.
It does. I think, you know, the women there, from what I found in my interviews and getting to know them as people, first of all, their stories are very rich and there's a lot of overlapping layers to their stories. And some of them are quite similar, of sort of tragic beginnings and endings and all sorts of things that you can imagine of what gets somebody where they are in that occupation, I suppose. But, you know, they fought like sisters. I think Kathy and Tracy were kind of mother hens to them, and they were sort of like annoyed with them like they were their daughters and stuff like that. So there is this real familiar family atmosphere. And at the end of the day, these women work 6 days a week. The Claremont Lounge, oddly, is closed on Sundays, which is kind of ironic. But and then I think it's closed on several holidays like Thanksgiving, Christmas, and 4th of July. Random. And so, you know, you're spending Christmas Eve with these women. They're a family. They're there all the time together. There were, while I was interviewing people, there was a mother and daughter that danced, not together on stage at the same time, but they were definitely working shifts together. So there is a family component, lots of cousins and, you know, a bartender whose sister then came and sort of that sort of stuff. Somebody told me once, it's almost like a subculture within a subculture. And I truly think that. While I was working on the book, there's a story of one of the members of the band, Mumford & Sons. He got kicked out for bringing out his phone and trying to take pictures. So they really don't let anybody do it, whether you're, you know, a famous rock star or me. I wasn't allowed to take pictures.
You got kicked out too, didn't you?
Well, Blondie kicked me out of the dressing room more than once.
How come?
You know, I was in their space. They didn't know me. And they certainly have, a lot of the dancers have been very much burned by journalists and writers. And there was a part of me that questioned my role in the project and exploiting them and not telling their story fairly or leaving somebody out and getting to know a girl that I couldn't put in the book because I just didn't have creative control over that. That certainly happened. There are two women in the book that I spoke with extensively and pushed very hard to get in the book. And, you know, it just didn't happen. So I think they are cautious and rightfully so, you know. I think somebody that comes in and speaks to them for an hour can then go out and make up whatever story they want, potentially. And I wanted, it took me a lot of time to let them know I hopefully could cross that bridge where they didn't think I was like that.
And Blondie is one of the strippers, a legendary stripper for a particular skill.
Yes. She has a lovely skill. You know, it is. She's famous for it. She crushes Pabst beer cans with her breasts. And she says she needed a niche and she found it and she became famous for it.
So the book was published in what, 2013?
It was actually in 2014. Okay, so my part of the project was done, but we went to print and it came out in 2014.
So by that time, Ethan Orley, principal with developer Oliver Hospitality, had bought it, right? In what, 2012?
That's right. I believe the deal of the hotel, the building being sold, happened in 2013 in January. And But during the bulk of my interviews, you know, this was looming. While I was working on the story for the book and at the lounge all the time, the hotel was derelict. And all these horrible articles were coming out about there's bed bugs here and this is not a place for anybody.
He said he might have to wear a hazmat suit when you went in the place.
That's right. It was awful. And there was one man that kind of was the caretaker, Bill. And he showed us around the very first time I ever went there and showed me all the way up to the roof. And they talked about how much it would be, you know, conceptually to redo the place. And they were like, oh, it'll probably cost $1 million. And, you know, at the time I was thinking, it's going to cost a lot more than $1 million.
I think it cost $30 million.
That's right. I think it probably, yeah, times 30. So, but you could see the roots of the building that were so beautiful. And the former owners, the Loudermilks, who Stanley mm-hmm. Mack had the original handshake deal with to get the lounge in the Claremont Hotel, his wife, Lillian, Tracy tells a story about her, you know, on her hands and knees waxing these marble floors. So you knew the building itself was so beautiful. It had just, you know, somebody just couldn't keep it up. It was always looming in interviews that I did with Tracy and Kathy of who was going to buy this building. And what that meant for them.
And what does it mean for them? Are they still there?
They are still there. At the time, though, that I will say that they were scared. They were scared it wouldn't be the Claremont. And one of the best quotes I have from Tracy is when Mack willed the club was, the Claremont is the Claremont because it's the Claremont, i.e. don't change it. So she had this real pressure, I think, for herself that she knew that's what set it apart. So here you have this developer coming in and potentially building this boutique hotel. And at the time, the interviews I had, it's funny because almost all of what they said sounded like fantasy and like kind of Chicken Little, like the sky is falling, but it all really happened. They were like, and they're going to put a restaurant here and they're going to do this mm-hmm. and it'll be a boutique hotel. And honestly, yeah, it's all of that.
It is stunning. And it's a beautiful renovation.
That's right.
It was Reunion Goods and Services, I think a New York studio that oversaw it. Eclectically lavish is one of the ways that I've seen it described. Rock and roll meets grandma's living room, you know? They did a really beautiful job, but it's interesting that the roots, the foundation at the very bottom, the Claremont, has stayed pretty much the same.
It has. To the best of my knowledge, it really has. And I think there's something really remarkable about that. And you can even think of that in terms for Atlanta because, you know, if I'm going to take a stance on it, I will absolutely say having a boutique hotel in this building, in this place and time, across from Pond City Market, it is amazing that this is happening. It's amazing that it's happened. It's a treasure that was completely derelict, that building. So I'm glad it's there. Atlanta desperately needed a boutique hotel.
So does Atlanta also need a somewhat seedy strip club at the bottom of a basement?
Why not?
Dana Scythe, who collaborated on a photo book about the Claremont Lounge called No Cameras. You'll find a link for more at gpbnews.org.